Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit. Bandwidth for the Tech Guy is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com.
Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. This show originally aired on the Premier Networks on Saturday, June 10th, 2017. This is episode 1394. Enjoy. The Tech Guy podcast is brought to you by 23andMe, an online genetic analysis company that helps you understand your 23 pairs of chromosomes, your DNA. Get over 75 genetic reports today and start exploring your DNA at 23andMe.com/twist. And by Wistia, the video hosting platform that powers creative communication for more than 300,000 businesses. Why not yours? Start your free account today, free at Wistia.com. And by Upside, the smart new way to save big money on business travel. Visit Upside.com, enter the code TechGuy, and you're guaranteed at least a $100 gift card when you book your first trip. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy. Time to talk about tech, computers, the internet, home theater, digital photography, smartphones, smart watches, virtual reality, augmented reality, real reality, talking devices, listening devices, NSA spy devices. It's all in here. Anything with a chip in it, that's what we talk about. Now, I'm not going to give you the phone number today because I'm not really here. I know. This is a fresh, brand new show. You've never heard it before, but I'm playing a little trick on you because I recorded it earlier because I am actually now in South America on vacation. So, but we didn't want to leave you in the lurch. So we got a brand new show today, brand new show tomorrow. Next week, I've got fill-ins, but great ones. Our home theater guru, Scott Wilkinson, will be here on Saturday. If you get the Saturday show, for those who listen to the Sunday show, it'll be Jason Snell, former editor-in-chief at Macworld Magazine, editorial director at IDG. He knows all about technology. Great guy. So you'll get brand new shows for the next 4 weeks, even though I'm not around. Because I'm traveling, and I know this is coming up for a lot of people, I'm really thinking about what technology to bring on the road with me. And there's a couple of reasons for this. Reason number one, of course, is the new rule in some cities, not all cities, not the cities I'm going to, fortunately, but it may eventually be in all cities, that you have to take all the electronics out of your bag, not just your laptops. Everything comes out. That's a big shift. There is also the issue I'm going out of the country, and as you know, overseas flights lately from some countries, you can't bring a laptop on. And there's always the risk, even if you're a U.S. citizen, that if you come back into the country, that Customs and Border Patrol, you know that the Fourth Amendment, the right against unlawful search and seizure, is suspended at the border. I don't know if you know this. I didn't know this. This is a constitutional lawyer told me. The Customs and Border Patrol has the legal right to do things, even to American citizens, that they couldn't do once you're in the country, including, and this is the thing that worries me, asking for the passwords to my laptop, to my phone, asking me to unlock my phone by putting my finger on the fingerprint reader, and reading the contents of my phone. Now, there's some debate, and I don't know how this comes down. The Electronic Frontier Foundation, the ACLU, and other organizations representing travelers' rights say, yeah, they can't really do that. The ACLU says, if you get stopped, if you're a U.S. citizen and you get stopped at the border and they ask, you know, to look at your electronics, call us. But, you know, I don't want to do that. I don't want to be cooling my heels in airport jail for a few hours while they fight it out. Maybe eventually they'll let me go. But I think you would, and I'm probably going to just say, yeah, here's my password, if they ask. Now, of course, Customs and Borders Patrol says, well, we only ask in a small, I mean, it's a tiny fraction of the cases, one in 1,000, one in 10,000 travelers. Nevertheless, it's something to consider. Because if they do take my phone. And by the way, this happened recently at my local airport, at San Francisco International Airport, to a U.S. citizen coming back into the country. They said, give us your phone and unlock it and give it to us. And he said, well, what if I don't want to? They said, well, you're an American citizen. We can't hold you, but we'll delay you by hours. You'll be sitting here for a while. So he said, okay. Now, this guy was a NASA scientist, works for the Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena. And he actually had a government phone, a phone given to him by the JPL. He said, it's a JPL phone. They said, we want it. So he unlocked it and gave it to him against his better interest, but just because he wanted to go home, wouldn't you? He'd been to South America, by the way. There's another reason I'm a little nervous. Now, the problem is, it's one thing if they open your phone and they look at it and they go, okay, fine, they give it back to you. But they didn't do that. They took it. And they went to another room for half an hour, and then they gave it back to him. Now, as you've heard me say many times, if you lose control of your computers, your phones, your laptops, your tablets, if somebody gets physical access to them, all bets are off. You can have all the protections in the world, but if somebody has physical access to your machine, you don't know what they've done. They could do all sorts of things. I don't know what Customs and Border Patrol is doing. I don't know why they wanted an American citizen's phone. I understand. I mean, we all want safe borders. We all want to be protected against terrorism. But at this point, you got a problem because your phone could have anything on it. They could have put spyware on it. They could have put a remote access Trojan. They could put software on there that would log your keystrokes or take pictures periodically or listen on your microphone. And there's no way to know. Even wiping the phone wouldn't necessarily fix that, depending on, you know, how sneaky they were. He went back to the JPL and he immediately told the IT department, look, this phone's been compromised. They took it. They wiped it. They went through some serious processes to make sure that, you know, data, private data was protected. I'm an individual. I don't have that luxury. I would be giving them my phone, which means they would have probably access to my password vault. They would have access to all my social media accounts. They'd have access to my private data backups. I use a network attached storage drive to store all my data. They'd have access to that. My life would be compromised. So a lot of people are trying to decide, you know, when they travel, if they travel outside the U.S., if what to do. My friend Mike Elgin, who is a world traveler, we call him a digital nomad. Right now he's living in Morocco, wrote an article for Computer World, get ready for the coming business travel crisis. And he points out that even though at this point, as I speak, there is no laptop travel ban, companies have to prepare. If there were an incident, it would happen very quickly. The next day, for instance, laptop travel bans would be in effect. You would have to check your laptop. You'd lose control of your laptop. If you're coming across a border, you might lose control of your devices. He points out that businesses should be thinking right now about what their employees travel with. Do they travel with a sanitized phone that's got nothing on it? Do they travel with a burner laptop that, you know, a Chromebook or something that has nothing on it? If you've got proprietary business information on those devices, personal information on those devices, how do you protect it? What do you do about this? And it's a serious issue for a lot of businesses that, you know, have stuff they don't want getting out, proprietary business information. It's a good article. I'll put a link in the show notes at techguylabs.com, where you can just Google Computer World, Mike Elgin, and travel crisis. That'll probably do it for you. So I've been thinking about this. You know, there's a password manager, 1Password, that has, I think this is very clever, a travel mode. You mark your passwords travel safe and not travel safe, and probably only a handful are travel safe. And then there's a button that you press when you get on the plane, before you hit customs, before you hit the TSA, you press a button that says, I'm in travel mode. It deletes every other password. And only the travel safe passwords are left. Then when you get home and it's okay, it'll restore it all. And it does it all undetectably. Now, everybody's very clear, including the ACLU, do not lie to Customs and Border Patrol. Be absolutely scrupulously honest. Do not lie to the TSA, and I'm not advocating that. But you might want to take steps to wipe your data and maybe even carry devices that, should they be compromised, should you be the one in 10,000 that's pulled aside and they take your phone and go into another room, you can throw that phone out because that's probably what you should do. So I'm about to travel across the border. Am I going to do any of this? No. And I bet you won't either. But I do think it's kind of worth thinking about. And when I get back, I'll let you know. Probably won't be any problem, right? All right, we're going to go to the phones, take your calls. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Again, don't call because we're pre-recording this, but I will be answering some calls, some brand new stuff coming up right after this. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, to the phones we go. Kyle, Columbus, Ohio, first on the show today. Hi, Kyle.
Hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Yeah, I had a question about cell phone plans. Is it better to be on Google Project Fi and pay per data, or be on like a T-Mobile unlimited plan?
Isn't that an interesting question? Yeah, the way Google does it, you pay $10 per gigabyte of data or whatever fraction. T-Mobile's unlimited plan, I understand, is unlimited, well, only in the sense that they don't throttle you until you've eaten 28 gigabytes, but that's more almost a gigabyte a day. You know, the best way to figure this out would be look at your usage. You go back and look at the last few months' cell phone bills. See how much data you use. Most people, if they're not using it as their home internet, might use 2, 3, 4 gigabytes a month, right? So Google Fi, the calculation is $20 per phone. That includes voice and unlimited text, plus the data. So if you use 3 gigabytes of data, that'd be $30 or $50 total. That's less than the $70 T-Mobile charges for unlimited. So it would be a better deal for you. On the other hand, if you use more than 6 gigabytes of data, or actually if you use more than 5 gigabytes of data a month typically, then your phone bill will be $70 plus. And is it T-Mobile's 70 or 80? I can't remember. They used to be 70. They might be 80.
T-Mobile's 70.
70? All right. So I guess the cutoff is 5 gigabytes of data a month. If you use more than that, T-Mobile would be a better deal. So you just got to go back and look at your bills because everybody's different. I, on my Google Fi, I think is a better deal. I save money. My typical bill's $30 or $40 every month.
Yeah, I don't use a whole lot of data. I use less than 1 gig, and my last phone bill was only $28.
There you go. So Google Fi would be $20 plus whatever you use, and they charge fractions, right? So if you used half a gig, it'd only be $5. So $25 for, you know. So that, I think that's a good deal. Remember, they don't charge you extra for texting. They have fairly affordable per minute call rates. I think it's a very good deal. The other thing that Google Fi does that I kind of like, they're aggregating service from a number of different carriers. So their primary service is T-Mobile. So whatever connectivity you're getting from T-Mobile, you're going to get at least that. But if T-Mobile isn't as good as Sprint in an area, they'll use Sprint instead. And if T-Mobile and Sprint aren't as good as U.S. Cellular in an area, they'll use U.S. Cellular. And this is maybe a pro or con, but whenever possible, they'll use Wi-Fi. For calling, for data, for texting, they'll use Wi-Fi. So, because that doesn't cost them anything. That's really kind of on your internet or whatever internet you're using. So, in my opinion, your connectivity is probably going to be better with Google's Fi service. Only because they're giving you, you know, 3 different carriers you can use plus Wi-Fi. There is a downside. Google's Fi, which you can find at fi.google.com, requires that you use a Google phone, one of last year's Nexus phones or one of this year's Pixel phones. It doesn't work on anybody else's phones. And I'm waiting to see. I haven't heard anybody say, oh, yeah, we'll work with Fi too. But here's a kind of a little trick. If you have an unlocked phone, a carrier unlocked phone, you can usually put a Google Fi SIM in there, but it won't do the frequency hopping. It'll stick with usually T-Mobile in my experience. So I can take my T-Mobile, AT&T, or maybe Verizon iPhone. If it's unlocked, if I can use somebody else's SIM in there, pop the Fi SIM, and it'll still work. But it just won't have all the features of Fi. I mean, it won't be able to roam to Sprint or U.S. Cellular. So it is, you know, it's more flexible than one might think. I'm a big Fi fan, and as I travel, I think Fi is going to be a good choice. Hey, thanks for the call, Kyle. I appreciate it. Fern, Junction City, Kansas. Hi, Fern.
Hi, Leo. I have what will probably be a very simple question for you.
Good, because I'm exhausted. I don't... My brain is strained.
I have a Verizon tablet with a keyboard, and when I go to do my email, it automatically brings up the other keyboard up on my screen, and I have to press on my little power button, I guess, on my regular keyboard to take that off of the screen. Is there some way I can fix that so that doesn't pop up every time? I have to remove it every time.
Well, it's supposed to know that you've got a keyboard attached via Bluetooth.
Oh.
And so if it knows that, but, you know, I think that may be just kind of the way it is.
I have to put up with it?
Yeah, because when you paired your keyboard, it knew it was a keyboard, right? I mean, in your Bluetooth settings, it says Bluetooth keyboard, right?
I presume.
Yeah. And, you know, on iOS, the way they do it, they have little keyboard connectors on the bottom. Apple's pretty good about this kind of thing. And if it sees a keyboard, it says, oh, I'm not going to pop up an on-screen keyboard. You don't need that.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe the chat room can help us. Anybody in the chat room have an experience with Android devices and Bluetooth keyboards? You'd think if Android looked in the Bluetooth settings and saw, oh, we're paired with a Bluetooth keyboard, I won't pop up the on-screen keyboard. You'd think it'd do that. But I guess it doesn't. Yeah.
Kind of an annoyance.
It's annoyance. I mean, there's a button. You press the button and it swoops out of the way. But it is an annoyance. It should know that automatically.
Mm-hmm.
You might try, just in case, you might try repairing the keyboard. Maybe it didn't get the message.
Oh, okay.
That it's a keyboard. It's a keyboard. It's a keyboard. And maybe it just, you know, didn't register that. Because if it registers it's a keyboard and it sees the keyboard connected, it shouldn't automatically pop up the on-screen.
I probably wouldn't know how to do that. I'd have to take it back into the shop and have them do it.
It's not that hard. You go to settings.
Okay.
And there's a Bluetooth section. You go into the Bluetooth stack section and you'll see a list of Bluetooth devices. One of them should be that keyboard.
Okay.
And you can then press and hold it and forget it. Now, before you do that,
okay, I just now pulled that up on the Bluetooth, and all it shows is ZAGG Folio.
That's the keyboard, the Zag Folio.
Okay, okay.
Yeah,
so it shows that.
It shows it. You know what? Maybe it doesn't know it's a keyboard. You know?
Hmm.
All right, here's a little hack. You ready for a hack?
I guess so.
This is from the chat room. There is apparently what they call a null keyboard app. Now, the problem with doing this is that it's going to make your keyboard disappear. And this actually comes from somebody who had this exact problem that you're talking about. That even though he has a Bluetooth keyboard for his Samsung Note, the virtual keyboard keeps popping up even when the Bluetooth keyboard is connected. So he found an app, and you'll find it in the App Store, called Null Keyboard, N-U-L-L Keyboard. It installs as an Android keyboard, but it doesn't do anything. It pops nothing up. So it'll still try to pop up a keyboard, but nothing will come up. Now, you'll have to remember you installed that, because if you don't have your physical keyboard, you'll have to switch keyboards on your Android device back to the regular keyboard. It doesn't break it. Null keyboard. We'll put a link in the show notes to all this at techguylabs.com. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. I know that sounds like kind of complicated, Fern. Does that all make sense to you?
Well, kind of, but it also says when I pull up that Bluetooth site, it says available devices, and it says no nearby Bluetooth devices were found.
That's because you already have the Zag.
Okay, and then it says something QTAQZ3 is visible to nearby devices while Bluetooth setting is open.
Yeah, that means that's fine. If there were any, while you've got that open, if there were any other devices you'd wanted to pair. So if you had eliminated the keyboard, and then it would see it and you would see the keyboard and you could add it, but you don't need to do that. This is kind of a weird a weird fix, which is, you know, you can have more than one keyboard in there. And with null keyboard, you just switch to null keyboard and no keyboard will ever pop up again. But I don't, you know, the problem with that is you got to remember you did that. Otherwise, you know, yeah, you're going to be calling me in about 6 months saying, my keyboard never comes up.
I don't even think I'll try it. I may take it into the store and tell them the problem, and maybe they'll be able to fix it. I don't know, but I'm not that smart.
there's also, and I want to put a link in the show notes to this Guiding Tech article. This is a good article because he also mentions a settings program that will make the on-screen keyboard disappear the minute you hit one key on the physical keyboard, because it'll go, oh, you got a keyboard, never mind. But that's not in the default settings. Well, wait a minute. No, you have to install something called Any Soft Keyboard. That's ridiculous.
Okay.
In other words, this is a problem other people have.
Okay. Well, maybe I'll just put up with it. It's really not that bad, but
yeah, no, I don't. You know,
annoying.
I am a big believer in not, you know, like fixing these little tiny annoyances, because they just, it's like death by a thousand paper cuts. They just bit by bit, they just drive you crazy. So,
well, I sure appreciate your show. I am really computer illiterate, but I find your show very interesting. I listen to it every Saturday afternoon on our local radio station,
and I
thoroughly enjoy it. You do a wonderful job.
Oh, bless you. Thank you so much.
All right.
Have a great day, Fern.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
We must have a good station in Kansas. We're starting to get a lot of calls from Kansas. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy. You know what that music means? No, neither do I, but it's strange music. Maybe it has something to do with this guy lurking over my shoulder. Scott Wilkinson is here. He's our home theater geek, hosts the Home Theater Geeks podcast at twit.tv/HTG. He's also the editor-in-chief at the very prestigious, very useful AVS Forum at avsforum.com. What does AVS stand for?
Audio Video Science.
Ah, cool.
So we try to be scientific about things. Certainly, there are always subjective opinions, and that's fine. But when we come to evaluating products and so on, we really want to stick to science.
They've been around for a long time, because I remember using them for hacking my TiVo.
Yep.
Series 1 TiVo. So they haven't been around for almost 20 years, I think.
I think it was started in 1999.
Wow. That's awesome.
Yeah.
So, Scott, what do you want to talk about today?
Well, I thought we might talk about helping the elderly enjoy their TV experience.
Well, it's about time, because I can't hear a damn thing. Siri,
well, you know,
we got a call a couple of weeks ago from a couple in their 80s.
Yeah.
They said, have they changed how stuff is done? Because is there any way? I can't hear the dialogue very well anymore.
Well,
and I said the same thing. Now, some of it is age, right?
Some of it is, certainly. Some of it is how the TV show is produced. In particular, my wife and I love the show Elementary, but the sound is mixed so poorly that we barely can understand it ourselves.
Well, that's what I theorize, that maybe it's being mixed for surround speakers.
Well, even if it were, though, the dialogue would typically be in the center channel, which is
where it needs to be. But if you didn't have surround speakers,
it should all collapse down to stereo.
But that's the problem. It's a big mush pile of sound.
It could be. There are a couple of solutions. I mean, typically, the older folks don't want any complication, right? They
right.
want it to be as simple as possible.
Yeah.
And yet the TV sound itself is really bad, typically, because these TVs nowadays are so thin, you can't really fit a good speaker in there.
Yeah.
So my first suggestion on that score is to get a sound bar. You know, you don't have to get a full surround system, an AV receiver, and all that jazz. You can just get a sound bar and put it under the TV. Or in some cases, I actually prefer what's called a sound base, which is a larger, low box that you actually put on the table and then put the TV on top of it.
Why would that be better?
Because a sound bar that you put in front of the TV on the table or whatever might be tall enough to block the TV's infrared sensor.
Oh, I've had that happen. And the remote stops working.
And then the remote stops working.
I have had that happen.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's why I sometimes prefer a sound base, because it doesn't block the TV's IR receiver, the little window that it gets the IR commands from the remote. Now, I did some research on this, and there's a company called ZVox, Z-V-O-X. They've been around a long time. They've been around as long as I've been in this business. And their sound, they make sound bars and sound bases, which have a feature called AccuVoice.
Oh.
And it's specifically aimed at the hearing impaired. And it takes the frequencies that the voice typically is in, which for consonants is in the 2 to 4 kilohertz range, and boosts that. They say they use hearing aid technology. I'm not quite sure what that means, but it's a really great idea for folks who have a harder time hearing the dialogue.
Now, if you got just a regular sound bar, could you still boost the dialogue by saying turn up the center channel?
Well, yes, you could potentially do that.
Okay.
If it has an equalizer function of any sort, typically called EQ, then you would want to boost typically the highs. If it only has like high and low, you remember the old...
Turn up the treble? That makes
turn
voices...
Turn up the treble.
Okay.
It makes voices sound better.
Okay.
Exactly. More distinguishable or more intelligible.
Well, that's probably why we can't understand voices as we get older, because we lose our high-end hearing.
Precisely. That is precisely right. Therefore, if you're just using the TV sound itself, I did this for my mom, actually. You go in and... You go into the audio menu, and most TVs have at least a bass and a treble control, and you either turn down the bass or you turn up the treble. Mm. You don't want to turn it up too much because it'll then sound very noisy. It could sound, you could get a lot of hiss.
Yeah.
So
I noticed that when I wear hearing aids, mm-hmm. I can hear my clothes rustling. I can hear my feet rubbing against the carpet. It sounds like when I'm walking, it sounds like
yep. Yep,
because I'm not used to hearing that high end.
That's right.
Yeah.
Because you know, over the years, all of us, as we age, the high frequencies in our hearing profile tend to drop.
Are you saying teenagers can hear their clothes rustling and that carpet sounds like? Shh, shh, shh.
I don't remember myself.
I wouldn't know. It's been quite a while. So what sound bar do you like? What do you recommend?
Well, the ZVox ones, I think in particular, are very, very good.
And how much are we talking here?
Oh, we're talking a couple hundred bucks.
Okay. And all the sound will be better, too, right? Because they're better than TV speakers.
Absolutely. Yeah. No question about it.
So they give you more control and they sound better.
Yep.
Yeah.
Now, we just ran a piece on AVS Forum, which was actually a reprint from a website called Wirecutter, which is another great site.
Love the Wirecutter, yeah.
And they recommended one of the Vizio.
They like the Vizios, yeah.
Soundbars.
Yeah.
And I do, too. I like them a lot.
And they're very inexpensive.
Yes, exactly. And some of them even have full surround. They'll do the front three channels in the soundbar. They'll have a subwoofer, too, which the ZVoxes don't, which gives you the low frequencies, which aren't as impacted by hearing loss, typically. And then they'll give you actually two surround speakers as well. So you can get a full 5.1 surround system with control of the center channel. You can raise the center channel. I don't remember exactly what the EQ controls are, but probably they have some sort of EQ control that could help with that too. Now, the other problem that we want to address here is control, right? You've heard the classic meme of, oh, man, my TV, my coffee table is full of remotes. Got one for the TV, one for the soundbar, you got one for the
that.
It's a nightmare. So you want to incorporate all those into something much easier.
Yeah.
My general recommendation in that regard is the Logitech Harmony series of universal remotes.
I got a Harmony Hub the other day. Do you like those?
Oh, yeah. No, I haven't tried one yet. Do you like it?
Yeah. The idea is you can talk to it, because if you have an Amazon Echo.
Right, exactly.
You can talk to the hub, and the hub somehow sprays infrared all over everywhere because
yes.
It just sits in one spot, but it can control all the devices just from there.
Because it's got a very broad beam angle. It just sends it out everywhere. Yeah, you're exactly right. But if you get a Harmony remote or a hub or something like that, then you can integrate the operation of all your products into one remote. Now, as you and I both know, we help our aging parents set this stuff up. And that means we do have to help them set up the harmony and set up the sound bar.
It's not easy. Yeah.
That's not necessarily so easy, but it's easier for us, for you and me anyway, than it is for our parents.
Well, I don't know. I think I'm becoming my elderly parents. I'm going to get my kids to help me.
Yeah, well, there will come that time, yes.
That's why you should be nice to your kids. My son always said, be nice to me. I'm choosing your nursing home.
Exactly.
That shut me up,
Yeah, right. Yeah. In a hurry.
Yeah.
But you do need to invest a little time. But once you've done that, it's going to be so much easier for them to control.
One remote.
And, or even voice command, possibly, with the hub.
Yeah.
And you'll be able to hear much better the sound coming from the TV.
Very nice. Very, very nice. Or get a dog and have him tell you what they said. What did they say? Scott Wilkinson, he's at the AVS Forum, avsforum.com. And don't forget his great podcast, the Home Theater Geeks podcast. Every Thursday, it's on my Twit network. You can find all the shows he's ever done at twit.tv/HTG. And, of course, we'll see you right here next week. Thank you, Scotty.
You betcha.
Leo Laporte, the tech guy. More calls coming up. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy. We get back to the phones now. Our next caller comes to us, let's see, from Mission Viejo, California. David is on the line. Hi, David.
Hey, Leo. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Doing okay, thanks.
What can I do for you on this fine Saturday afternoon?
Well, I've got a question for you. I'm a teacher, and my school district blocks Netflix from being used in the classroom.
Of course they do. Of course they do. How dare you try to watch Phineas and Ferb in the middle of the school day?
That's right. Yeah. But there's so many great things. And
I know. I have a little problem. You know, when I was on the board of our local high school, and they used to block Facebook and all sorts of stuff. And I said, you know, these kids are never going to learn how to deal with distractions if you do it. And by the way, they have smartphones. So
I know they're all on it anyway.
It's not accomplishing
YouTube.
Yeah,
this year to the kids, we still can't get Facebook, which I'm fine with. But Netflix would be wonderful. And Netflix, in a conversation with them, they don't have any problem because I'm a subscriber. I'm using it in a classroom. They have no problem with it. It's the
So, and you're right. There's so many good documentaries. I watch Netflix documentaries all the time, and I love it. And boy, these would be a lot better than those old film reels they had when I was a kid. Your little footlins and ink. Yeah, I know. Those were no fun. So,
projector.
The projector never worked. There's no fix for this. You have to get permission from the school board.
Well, they're not going to give it. My tech department at the school, they're flat against it. And I just wondered if there's some way to get around it.
Not using the school's internet.
Well, understandable, but how do I actually do that from my desktop computer so I can play it on that projector?
Well, if you have a device that gets internet from the cellular network, for instance,
make my iPad a hotspot.
Make your iPad a hotspot. If the speed is sufficient, you could totally do that.
But then I'd have to be on LTE to do it. Correct?
Yeah, you'd really want the highest speed connection you can get. LTE is adequate for Netflix. So you could, you know, any device that is on the LTE should be able to play a Netflix movie. But, you know, it's using your bandwidth. So it could end up costing it could cost you some money. A typical Netflix movie is about a gigabyte.
Hmm.
So
yeah.
If you did that 4 days a week, you'd run out of internet very quickly. You're stuck with, unfortunately, you're stuck with the policy. If you're going
to
use their internet.
Where do I have to go into the computer? Then I would have to share a network, and the only network available would be the district Ethernet or Wi-Fi.
Right. Right. You're stuck with the restrictions that they place on their network. There's no good way to get around that.
I had a bad feeling.
Yeah. Do they allow YouTube?
You know what? They've allowed me to use YouTube for a while, even though we have to log in. They canceled that this year, so you can just get onto YouTube, and the kids can, starting, just maybe 6 months ago, with unlimited access.
I understand their desire to keep kids from, you know, getting distracted in school, But
YouTube is much more distracting than Facebook or Netflix.
Yeah. Now, there is one thing that might help you. There are, on iOS now, you can download some Netflix content. It's, it's mostly the Netflix originals.
Exactly. I looked into that when that was first offered a few months ago, but it didn't seem to work anyway when I took it into the classroom because I still needed a...
Oh, you need a connection to Netflix to make it legal.
Right.
All right, we're now going to go really extra legal here, and because I suppose there may be Netflix downloaders that would allow you to download any Netflix content. This is highly illegal. There's a hole that nobody can prevent, called the analog hole, that gets through copy protection. And the fact that you have to be able to play the content on your TV is the flaw in the copy protection ointment. If you could capture it as if you're playing it to your TV, but instead playing it to a disc, then you could save the Netflix content to the disc as if it was a TV and then play it back. Now, I noticed there was a program, the operative word, a free downloader for Netflix, and there's a big bar across it that says, the development of free downloader for Netflix is discontinued by third-party requests. Guess which third party? This program is not. Nobody wants to go up against a company with lots of money and lawyers.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah. So that's the first thing I Googled, but that would be your only way around this is to, at home, figure out a way to capture Netflix and then play it back at school. For instance, you could DVR it somehow, or you got a VHS recorder. You could record it and then bring it to school and play it back.
That would be nice. I still have one of those. It's probably completely illegal now. One of those TiVo units that had a built-in DVD recorder.
Yeah.
In it.
And then it could burn it to a DVD. Yeah. So it's going to be kind of something like that. There are other services. It depends. A lot of the ones that still operate outside the U.S. because otherwise they would go to jail.
Right.
And I don't want to get you in trouble either with your employer or with, the copyright police, but that's kind of what you need to do.
Like I said, Netflix doesn't have a problem with it. I've spoken to them.
Well, you might contact them and say, look, here's the problem. I can't play back streams from Netflix because it's blocked at our district. Do you have any way that I could somehow get this content and play it back?
Mm-hmm. Maybe I'll contact them again.
Yeah, they might. I don't know how amenable they'd be to something like that. Remember, they have obligations to the content providers, the licenses that are that they sign, they agree to. In almost every case, one of the things Netflix is required to do is strongly protect this content. But there was a program called Replay that allowed you to do video capture. If you could play it back on your computer screen, you could capture it to the hard drive. Something like that would work.
Replay?
Yeah. Replay TV. Slysoft used to make these kinds of things. They were in the Trinidad and Tobagos. Even they got in trouble and shut down briefly, and I think they came back. So these are typically considered pirate tools. But I think what you're doing, especially since Netflix says it's okay to play these back in a school, is not pirating, but the law you're violating would be getting around the school's restrictions about what you can do in school, what you can do with the school's network. And if you're comfortable if you're comfortable with that, and you're
I have a problem with that.
You have tenure, I take it.
I do have tenure.
Yeah, I mean, I think that clearly the reason they block Netflix is not so teachers can't play documentaries. What you might inquire is there some way that we could have a separate connection for teachers that isn't as restricted as that for kids? The kids are mostly using Wi-Fi, right?
No, I think the kids are mostly using LTE or something like that because they want unlimited access while they're at school. And if they're on the district Wi-Fi, they're limited.
Uh-huh. But I'm just saying that most of the kids, if they blocked it on Wi-Fi and gave teachers Ethernet access and unrestricted Ethernet access, wouldn't that solve their problem with distracted kids? I don't know. That's to me your best avenue is get the school district to listen to the reason and, you know, say, look, I want to show this great free content. Netflix has given me permission. I just need a connection to the internet that isn't blocked. Thanks for your hard work as a teacher, David. I honor that. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. We'll be back with more of the Tech Guy in just a moment. Our show today brought to you by a very cool site that I have used. I used some years ago called 23andMe. It's an online genetic analysis company named after the 23 pairs of chromosomes that makes you, your DNA. Now, it's easy to do. You just send away. They send you the kit. It's a little vial. You spit into it. That's all. Send it back to them. And then they can send you a complete rundown of what your DNA means. 75 more than, they're always adding more. This is probably twice as many as when I first signed up for this. And that's, by the way, one great thing. You do it once and they got your genome mapped. You can even download the data yourself if you want to analyze it yourself or send it somewhere else. But you've got your genome mapped. And then as time goes by, they add more and more reports. You get a richer and richer look at what makes you you. Ancestry reports. That includes ancestry composition. You can tell how much Neanderthal is in you, which is fascinating. Your haplogroups. This is something fairly new. And I can see in time periods how my family tree has migrated from East Central Africa all the way up into Europe with time, like a timeline. It's amazing. You can use a DNA relative finder to connect with new relatives. I found a second cousin, and I know he's my second cousin, not only because his DNA is close to mine, but also because his last name is my grandma's maiden name. Well, how cool is that? And that list, by the way, grows as more and more people use 23andMe. It's one of the reasons I want you to sign up for 23andMe. Maybe you're my cousin. You can learn how your DNA influences traits, how it relates, for instance, to your caffeine consumption, your muscle type, your weight, your body type. It's genetically determined. Lots more with the 23andMe Wellness and Traits Report. They also have a carrier status report. Now, this is important. This meets FDA requirements. You may have heard about this. The FDA went to them and said, let's work this out because you're telling people stuff like they're a carrier for cystic fibrosis or hereditary hearing loss. They got FDA approval. You can get that information as well. And a lot more. Understand what makes you you. Get over 75 different genetic reports and start exploring your DNA today, right now, at 23andme.com/twit. I did it long before they were an advertiser. That's why when they came to us, I said, yes, I want to tell the world about this. It's so cool. 23andme.com/twit. Give it a try. And we thank them so much for making the Tech Guy podcast possible. Now back to the show. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. We go back to the phones, and looks like we've got Jim on the line from La Jolla, California. Hi, Jim.
Hello, Leo. Long-time listener.
Thank you. Long-time waiter, too. I appreciate your patience.
Okay.
You're a very patient fellow.
I'm running Windows 10 on a PC with an Apple router front-ending my old Time Warner data service. And I'm getting my email okay, but when I click on a link in the email, it goes into a long, long pause, and then I get a timeout message.
Yeah.
And I get the same response no matter which browser I'm using.
Yeah.
So it's not the browser.
Yeah, no, but it's not the router, I don't think, either. It's almost certainly the Windows File Association database. Oh, happy day. So as you know, when you click a link in Windows, Windows doesn't know what to do with that link, but it goes and it looks at a database that says, oh, when you have a URI, open this thing. So in the old days of Windows, I'd say, well, go in, there's a file associations, you know, control panel, but and it may still be there, probably is, but it's buried. The best thing to do, and I would at least start with this, is go and reset the file associations. And you can do that in Windows 10, you know, in the basic control panel. Not the Windows 10 has two control panels, one like the old style Windows 7 control panel that's hard to get to, and the one, the regular one that you usually see with the big letters. Go to the app section, and you'll see default programs. And there is a bug. I believe there's a bug in Windows 10. Every time I try to use Chrome, it breaks the default programs. But the trick is to reset it. So at the bottom of default programs, there's a reset all that will reset everything. And then try clicking that link and see if that fixes everything. Now, what it's going to do is launch Microsoft's Edge, because that's the default browser. But if that does fix it, then at least we know that's what the issue was file associations. I've had this problem with, you know, trying to use Chrome as a default browser. What do you use as your default browser?
Well, normally I use Chrome, but I've tried it with other Firefox and others.
Yeah, I think there's something broken in Windows 10 default program settings, because I will say, no, I want Chrome to be my default browser, and Microsoft will complain bitterly, but do it, and then it'll break. And then the trick to fix it, you click it, and there is no set for default, and you can't get your browser set. And the trick that I finally learned, I think somebody here told me in the chat room, hit reset, and then you can choose Chrome. It'll go back to Edge, and then you can choose Chrome. But so that's the first thing to try. And you can actually just hit Windows key default, and it'll open up that control panel. Hit reset. Mm-hmm. It'll reset everything back to Edge. Before you do anything else at that point, I would see if those links work. And if it does, then I think you're good. You can then go and change your default browser to whatever you want.
Okay.
I love it that Chrome bitches when you're using Edge, and Edge bitches when you're using Chrome. Can I use that word? I think it's an appropriate word. They're at each other's throats. Oh, you don't want to use that browser. We're so much better. And I wouldn't be surprised if this bug, I put that in air quotes, is really almost just an anti-competitive measure to keep you from, like, it doesn't really work very well if you don't use Edge as your default browser.
But even when I use Edge, I get the same effect.
I know, but it's not so much that. It's that you want to reset those file associations.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Now, if that doesn't fix it, then you're going to have a lovely time, because you're now going to the old control panel, the file associations control panel. Remember that from Windows 7? That's a load of fun. That's where all that stuff is stored. And what you're looking for is what happens when a URI, a universal resource something, is clicked. That's really annoying. Now, is it a file or just a link?
It's a link.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Somebody in the chat room said save the attachment. It's not a file. You're talking about just there's a link in the email.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not an attachment. So the link is a URI, and what's happening is the URI handling is broken. That's a file association. What I'm hoping is the simpler control panel will get the job done. If not, then you're going to dig into and you're going to look for the file associations for URI, and you're going to want to pick a browser. And that's the browser that will open when you click that link.
Would it be easier to try to reset Windows?
No. Well, I mean, it's like saying, would it be easier to kill a mosquito by shooting it with a 22? Yes, I guess. But perhaps there'd be side effects you would not enjoy. So, yeah, if things still don't get better, maybe. But really, I'm pretty sure that if you reset the defaults, that'll fix it. And if it doesn't, the problem is, you can go into file associations and really mess things up, because there's a lot of them. And so you got to pick the right one and do it. If you look at it and go, yeah, I don't want to go in there. Yeah. Reset. Get the 22 out. Maybe you better yet a 357 and really get that mosquito.
Okay, thanks for the
call. Yeah, you're welcome, Jim. I appreciate it. Yeah, that's something I've noticed that I really do think this comes out of Microsoft's. They really don't want you to use Chrome. And if you look at the browser usage trends, I can understand why. For years, Internet Explorer, Microsoft's default browser, was totally dominant. And then with the advent of Windows, did it start Windows 8 or Windows 10? I think Windows 8, they started using Edge as their default browser. And all of a sudden, you saw a line going, you know, straight down for usage for Internet Explorer. And the line for Edge didn't really go up that much. The line for Chrome went straight up. And at this point, Chrome's more than 50% of all browser usage. Firefox going down. Internet Explorer is going down. Edge is kind of flat. Safari on the Mac side, that's kind of flat. Chrome is really dominant. And I think but, you know, you got to understand that the browser is the key to the whole kingdom at this point. We really lived in a world, a Microsoft-dominated world, where the operating system was the key to the kingdom. In fact, I read a great article by a former Microsoftie, worked in the Office division, about what went wrong with Windows Vista. And really, if you boil it all down, and a lot went wrong, but if you boil it all down, it was Bill Gates' decision that the web, that HTML, the way the web worked, was not going to be the final, you know, operating system, the way we looked at documents. Maybe that was wishful thinking, or maybe he just misread the tea leaves. He thought the web was going away. And Microsoft went all in on a presentation layer called Avalon, that they thought all documents in the future will be displayed in Avalon. Nobody's going to use this HTML stuff. The web isn't going anywhere. And it was a bad bet. Right? Now you can use a Chrome OS where everything's rendered in a browser. Much of what we do on the internet is rendered in a browser. So all of a sudden, the operating system isn't as important as the browser. Windows, Mac, doesn't matter. If you use Chrome, you may never see Windows. And more importantly, all the revenue goes to Google, not to Microsoft. So you can see it's actually a bitter fight. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if this is a little bit of a, quote, bug that Microsoft introduced, because it just works better if you use Edge. Everything's better if you use our browser. Don't you think? It's just better that way. The sun shines brighter. The birds sing louder. Just use Edge. Forget that Chrome. Leo, we're going to keep talking about tech. Leo Laporte. The Tech Guy. Don't forget, we put everything, all the links and everything, at the website techguylabs.com. More calls right after this. Leo Laporte, The Tech Guy. Glenn on the line from Winnetka, California. Hello, Glenn.
Hello, Leo.
Welcome.
Thank you. I've got too much stuff on my boot drive, and it's, you know, I want to get it down so I can buy myself a 256 solid state drive and have that work. And I remember when I set up my computer, I transferred all my documents over to, you know, the data drive.
Good. So you have, so this, the boot drive is just Windows and applications.
Well, but it seems like it's still way too much stuff. And when I hear you talk about it, it's like it's trivial. Well, I'm not sure what all is on there, but apparently I've missed the boat.
Beware geeks using the word trivial. It almost never is.
Yeah.
Never is.
I was wondering, is it a tutorial or YouTube thing? Or
in my opinion, if you're going to put in a new hard drive, the idea is you want to just, if you can, clone that C drive, but you want to clean it up before you clone it.
Well, I want to take a whole bunch more stuff off the boot drive and put it over on the data side.
Right.
Because if I have to buy a terabyte and a half of data, who cares?
Yeah. That's nowadays. That's the thing. You know, buy a fast, speedy, but expensive boot drive, and then you don't mind if the data is on a slower spinning drive.
Yeah.
But really, in my opinion, two things that have to be on the boot drive are Windows and all its various accoutrements and all your applications. You can move the swap file. The page file doesn't have to be on the boot drive. In fact, it might be better not on the boot drive, but everything else can be moved. But Windows And all the Windows applications have to be on that C drive.
I guess I'm afraid I probably am not bright enough to recognize. I mean, you know.
Well, that's the risk, is you can move something and break it.
Well, and that's why, you know, I want a list, but it's, you know, a whole lot more of a list than just data. I mean, photos, I guess that's data too.
Photos should be moved over. Music should be moved over. Movies, those are the biggest files anyway. Documents, all of those could be moved to the D drive. Have you kind of browsed around on the C drive? Do you see what kind of stuff there is?
I remember doing that and remember being kind of confused that it's like,
how big is your C drive?
Well, right now it's about 350, but it's spinning.
Yeah. So Windows really can easily fit in a 50 gig partition.
Yeah.
Do you have a whole bunch of applications?
I've got quite a few. I mean, I'm not one of these nuts that takes all this free stuff. But,
well, you might want to uninstall anything you haven't used in a while. But 350 gigs is pretty darn big for a Windows directory.
Yeah. Well, and I'm afraid. I mean, probably the trash is on there. It's like...
Yeah, it is. But empty the trash, for sure. Clear the temp files. If you want to kind of look graphically at what's using space on there, we've recommended many times in the past a free program, probably a good thing to have, called WinDirstat, WinDirstat. It'll show you graphically, with big blobs of color, what's occupying space on there.
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of want to, you know, it could very easily be, you just missed it, a 50 gig movie file just sitting there. You know, there could be something odd that's just kind of hanging out in there.
Okay. I just wish there was a list of...
So you want a list of all the files on there?
No, I want a list of all the stuff I had to, you know, look for this and move that. You know,
right.
It's like, and here are the big things that you really ought to be moving out of there. But I've never seen a tutorial like that, and yet somebody's bound to have done one.
That's an interesting question. This might also be a great time for spring cleaning. that's the other way to do this is start from scratch with this nice, fresh, fast drive. 350 gigs and you want to buy a 256 gig or something like that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Why,
yeah, 256 is the largest because, I mean, they're so bloody expensive.
No, and that should be plenty big enough. I mean, I have plenty of laptops that have total 256 gigs, and I've never run out of space. So
yeah.
There's something big. Get WinDirstat and look what the big blobs are on there. I bet you there's something. You know,
when I look in there, I don't recognize what you do. I don't recognize.
Yeah, so you want to know what you're looking at.
And I
wish I could say, well, you definitely, I mean, I know you want to keep .exe and, you know, .exe and .com and .dll files. Those are all program files. But there's also, you know what else could be really big and maybe ballooned out of control is your that can be a big problem on Windows. And CC Cleaner will get rid of some of that stuff. Take a look at Piriform, PIRIFORM. Why can't I remember it, John?
I don't know. Does it have to become Bitcoin?
You know what I'm talking about?
No.
Oh, okay. You know, the registry. That's it. The registry.
Yeah.
Your registry could be don't throw it out. That could get over bloated. But CCleaner will fix that up from Piriform. You're not doing Bitcoin, are you?
Oh no, no,
no.
Well, I don't think I don't have the guts to go anywhere near the registry. Holy.
No, don't mess with the registry. But CCleaner will can maybe at least, you know what, it would at least tell you how big it is.
Yeah, yeah.
And CCleaner will get rid of temp files and stuff you know it knows you don't need. And that
I'll just be building up some more temp files, though, won't I? I
mean, yeah, but over time.
Yeah, okay. But there's no way to shift it over, so anytime there's a temp file, it's automatically on the data drive.
Yeah, there is. You can designate where your temp files go. Absolutely.
Oh, neat. Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's an easy thing to do. I'm trying to think of what
you say.
It's trivial, my friend. It's trivial. I'm trying to think of what could be occupying. I'm guessing it's going to be things like trash, temp files. But see, go to Piriform, PIRIFORM.com. Get Seek Cleaner. Clean up all the temp files. Don't aggressively modify the registry. That's a recipe for disaster. Mm-hmm. But I do feel like and Windows has a disk cleanup that'll get rid of a lot of those temp files as well. So just hit Windows key and cleanup, type C-L-E-A-N, and you'll see the cleanup program. You can run that. But I don't know what could possibly be so big. I don't know. I don't know.
I'd be curious how many of your other listeners.
Oh, this is common.
Yeah.
This is common. In fact, really the way I get around this is I say just once a year you should rebuild the whole darn thing. For instance, did you upgrade from an earlier version of Windows?
No, I didn't. I'm still on Windows 7.
Because one of the things, if you go to 10, they keep a file, large folder called Windows.old around that's got your old Windows in it.
Well, I was figuring that once I get a new computer and go on Windows 10, but I already want to know
I understand. Try some of these programs I recommend. The best thing to do, of course, would be start over, reinstall your apps. That'd save you the most space. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. He's been everywhere, man. He's Johnny Jett, our traveling guy from JohnnyJett.com. He is, I don't know how he's doing it, a new parent, little baby boy, Jackie Jett. And you're traveling, you're in Connecticut with Jack. This is his second flight. I noticed I'm very proud of you that you bought him a seat this time and put his car seat in the seat.
Well, actually, I did not buy it the second one. Because the plane wasn't full, I was able to bring the car seat on. So that's one way you can do it. But from now on, I've actually bought the car seat for every other flight.
I know it's expensive, but it's just so much safer than holding your baby in your lap.
I know, but one trick is, especially if you're buying tickets last minute, you could, look and see what the flight loads are, or call up and ask the agents what the loads are. Because if they're not that full and there's an empty seat, you can still bring your car seat on.
Good to know. Or bring a roll of duct tape and just duct tape them to the seat back, and then they won't go anywhere. And kids like to be swaddled. I'm just saying.
They sure do.
Don't listen to Leo. He's terrible. Don't.
A couple weeks ago, I mentioned a stroller that we use, but I didn't say the name, and everyone asked me. So it's called Doona, D-O-O-N-A.
Ah.
And that turns into the stroller turns into a car seat. So one flip of the button, I carry it onto the plane and put it in. But we have a flight coming up, and I don't know if it's going to fit in the bulkhead because the armrests don't go up. So I'll let you know next week.
Nice. So you're going to be here in Connecticut for a little while longer, and then you're coming home, or
I'm going on a road trip, so I'm about to drive down.
Baby's first road trip?
Well, he's actually been on a road trip to Palm Springs and San Diego, but we're going to check out the East Coast this time.
This kid is so well-traveled. It's amazing.
You tried. So, along the way, by the way, speaking of air flying, the most expensive day to fly this summer, do you know what it is?
The most expensive Memorial Day. No. I don't know. What?
July 9th, Sunday after.
The Sunday after the 4th of July.
Exactly. So that try and avoid. And actually, in general, try and avoid Sundays when you're booking tickets this summer, because those are the most expensive days. A study just came out, and so the cheapest days are usually Tuesday, Wednesdays. That's typically all the time anyway.
I thought, though, that you should always book a weekend because the business travelers pay more than the leisure travelers. And they presume if you're traveling – not in the summer. Okay, that's good to know.
Especially on Sundays, but even during the year, Sundays are always one of the most expensive days to fly.
We're really at a disadvantage because the airlines are using very sophisticated computer technology to maximize their revenue, and nobody on that plane paid the same price. Everybody paid something different, and it's very hard for us humans to suss it all out. But any tricks you can give us are valuable. Thank you.
For sure. And by the way, one trick to save some money or even make some money is a new app called Dosh, D-O-S-H.
Dosh.
And the website is dosh.cash, but it's an app. You download it. It's free on Android and iOS. And so what it does is you're supposed to – you register your credit card or your bank card. I recommend always using credit cards because if you, you know, your bank card ever gets compromised, it's tough to get the money back, unlike the credit cards, which you can. You're protected. But it's a real interesting way to make some money is because you just register your credit card and then you pay for it at a restaurant. And if there's a coupon available that, you know, there, all these restaurants.
Oh, I'm going to do this. This is great. So it does it for you.
Exactly. You don't even have to tell them. The waitress or waiter, you don't have to tell them that you're on Dosh. You just use that same credit card. You don't even need to break out the app.
Why wouldn't you use this? Holy cow. Dosh must stand for something.
I think it means cash.
Do open savings holdings or something. I don't know. It feels like it must stand for something. Anyway, Dosh.
I think it's slang.
It's slang?
I think so. But what's also cool
about
this?
Today, they speak a different language. I don't understand.
But what's cool about this app is that let's say you're booking a hotel.
Yeah.
You can book it through these guys, and they actually have. I was comparing.
Are you guys downloading Dosh right now? Both. That's great. Both of our Kian and Bree are downloading it right now. They're in the studio.
Oh,
that's good.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Well, this is. I mean, why wouldn't you? Is there a downside to this?
Well, the downside is let's say you do book a hotel through them. But to book hotels, you have to go directly through the app.
Ah.
But it's usually cheaper than, you know, the traditional online travel agencies. Usually at least a dollar cheaper, I think they say.
So apparently Dosh is Cockney slang for money.
Okay. So the one thing about booking, if you're booking like a major hotel brand like Marriott or Hilton through these guys and not through their website – you won't get your freaking flyer, your hotel rewards, or you won't get free Wi-Fi.
So I'm not going to dosh them. I'm just going to use it for buying other stuff.
No, but if you're booking like a boutique hotel, or if you're on a big expense report account, there's no reason not to. I mean, you can literally, it shows you how much money you can make, and after you accumulate up to $15 in Dosh, you can transfer it to your bank account or your PayPal or donate it, and there's no charge to download it. So it's really like it's a no brainer, except that one area.
Like TripIt will tell me. Oh, there you can get a refund on your ticket, but then I have to call them because the price went down. I have to call them and say, "Hey, you know, the price went down. I want my money," and I don't want to do that. So this is, you don't have to do anything; it just happens.
Especially for dining, and they have over 100,000 merchants and brands.
That's
so
great. Dosh.cash.
Yeah,
brilliant.
And actually, now that I don't think I've ever mentioned this site, but you just brought up a site. TripIt brings up.
Love TripIt.
You know, to get a refund. But, you know, there is a website called Tingo.com.
Tingo.
Let me just make sure it's still there. Okay. So what Tingo does, this is just totally ad lib, by the way. But Tingo actually does what you just said. If you book a hotel through them and that price drops, they automatically rebook you and get you money back.
And this
is owned by TripAdvisor, these guys. This was an independent.
I like
TripAdvisor.
TripAdvisor
bought them.
Do you trust TripAdvisor's reviews and all that? I do.
You know, with a grain of salt. So yeah. I mean, because you don't know if it's something really bad or something really good. Right. I don't really trust it. But if there's thousands of reviews, you know, you can get a pretty good sense. At least you can read the comments and you can. And I got some good tips. One time I think I mentioned it once before, I was going to Rio and I looked up the hotel I was staying at and someone's like, "Be careful. I've had my laptop stolen from the room." Ooh. It was inside job. So I knew to bring a lock for my laptop.
Tingo, TINGO.com from TripAdvisor will save you money and give you refunds on your bookings. But you raised an interesting question because Lisa will, and no matter what hotel, she will put anything valuable in the safe. And I always say, they're not going to rob you. I always leave my iPad and my laptop out and my wristwatch or whatever. Have you ever been robbed in a hotel?
Knock on wood, I don't believe so. But
I'm a
trusting
fellow.
Have.
Okay.
But the thing is, what I normally do is I always leave the do not disturb sign on. I don't want cleaning.
So
I think that's where the problem is.
That's a good idea. Don't let it in the room.
So I always leave it on.
Yeah.
Because I don't change my sheets every day at home or my towels. I'll do it once a week.
Okay.
So I act the same way. And I think that's the safest way in hotels.
That's a good idea.
Or if I'm going to have them clean the room, I'll have them do it while I'm in the room.
We were in a hotel where they had a safe, but it wasn't attached to anything. So I think it was just like a valuables collection device that the guy could just come and take it and he'd know everything was in there. It didn't make any sense. It wasn't attached.
In some hotels, they have the master combination. So
Of course they do, because people are going to forget. They better have the master. Yeah. See, that's,
And actually, always check 0000 because that is sometimes the universal master. So if you're ever in a hotel safe, check that and make sure that's not the code before you do it, because then you know that the safe can be cracked.
He is full of tips. He's Johnny Jett. JohnnyJett.com, the website. Get his travel newsletter. It's free. His travel tips. You should subscribe to everything he does. It's all great. Follow him on Twitter at Johnny Jett and on Instagram too. Thank you, Johnny.
Hey, thanks, Leo.
Safe travels. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy. We go back to the phones, and on the line right now from Pomona, California. No. No. Read it more carefully, Leo. On the line from Panama City, Florida. How about that? Matthew. Hi, Matthew.
Hey, Leo. How's it going, man?
It's going great. Panama looks like Pomona if you squint.
Yeah, kind of different, though.
Better weather, though, I think, in Panama City.
Yeah, going about 100 right now.
Oh, my gosh. A lot better. Or maybe not. What can I do for you, sir?
Well, I just got this new phone, and they put some liquid glass screen protector on it. It kind of feels like snake oil. So I'm not sure exactly what to think of it. Have you heard of it?
I have not. You know, I don't ever put anything on my phones. But then again, I don't keep a phone long enough to really cause a problem. If you want to keep a phone 2 or 3 years, it's probably a good idea at least to get a case. Then there's this whole aftermarket now covering the glass. Because the problem with all cases is they don't cover the glass of the phone. And guess what's the most vulnerable part? The glass of the phone. So if you drop it, unless you have a case with a lid, you know, and some of the OtterBoxes and other hardcore cases do have, you know, covers. I've seen these tempered glass layers. You know, it started with plastic, which is of dubious value. Real problem, it's a material science problem, that the less likely something is to scratch. You could make a phone surface with plastic. It wouldn't shatter, but it'd scratch like crazy, right? In fact, if you've ever had eyeglasses made out of plastic, you know it's not a good material. So you make them with something that doesn't scratch very easily, sapphire or glass, and those are fine. They're very hard, but anytime a material is that hard, it can also shatter. And if you hit it right, like on the point of a rock, it will shatter like crazy. So the question is, if I put a layer of something over on top of it, is that going to protect it? And I have my doubts. The tempered glass panels you can put over those, maybe. If you hit it, you know, it's really more for scratching, like if you, you know, had something.
Yeah, that's what I used them for in the past.
Yeah, it'll protect against scratches.
In my pocket with the keys. And
yeah. The thing I don't like about a spray-on thing, can you peel it off? How do you get it off?
No, you can't even tell it's on.
Well, that's good. but if it's there for scratch protection, it means it's going to scratch. Then you want to be able to peel it off and put a new one on.
And replace it, yeah. That's what I was thinking. It says it has a 9H hardness, so
I guess that's good. I mean, you know, look, this is a big business, Gorilla Glass from Corningware. In fact, it's a funny story because back in 2007, Corning, which is these guys are geniuses in glass, had made Gorilla Glass, but they were about to shut the factory because nobody wanted it. Along comes Apple. We got this new thing. It's got a lot of glass. Could we get some of that Gorilla Glass? They put Corning back in the Gorilla Glass business, and now it's a huge business for them. Even though Apple doesn't say we're using Corning glass, they do. And almost everybody does. And those Gorilla Glasses have gotten better and better. It's that same material science problem. How do we make something that doesn't scratch but also is less prone to shattering? And harder is better. Apple did apparently toy for a while with making sapphire phones. They do use sapphire for the Apple Watch. A lot of high-end watches use sapphire. That is a very, very hard substance. I wonder what the sapphire's hardness is now that you mentioned 9H.
I know diamond's, 10? So
yeah, I mean, 9 is level, sounds like 9's about as good as you can go. This is the Moh, M-O-H scale. Glass is 5.5 to 7 Mohs. Sapphire Crystal, like the one they sprayed your phone with, is 9 Mohs. And, of course, Diamond is 10. Diamond's as hard as you can get. And if Diamond were cheaper, we'd have Diamond phones. But, you know, making a big panel like that is tough. In fact, Apple's really never been able to make large panels for phones either out of Sapphire.
True.
So, yeah, if they're saying 9 or 9.5?
9.8. I'm not sure what that means, if half or... Maybe that just means 9 hardness.
9 hardness is probably a Mo. Gosh, you know, A...
And it says it's made out of, I guess, SiO2, so that would be what, silicone?
Silicon oxide, yeah.
Oxide, okay.
Yeah. It sounds like Falderol.
I was just figuring if it was that good, the manufacturer...
Everybody would do it. Right. Why wouldn't the manufacturer do it? It's like undercoating in your car.
Well, yeah.
If I really needed it, why didn't they do it at the factory? So... Where'd you buy this phone?
Oh, man, just a local retailer.
And did they spray it before you asked them?
No, they got my permission and everything.
Okay. And did they charge you for it?
Yeah, it was like $20.
Yeah. It's somebody's telling me that silicon oxide is quartz.
It's quartz?
So that's quartz. So, yeah, maybe. You know, will you call me back in a year and let me know?
Yep.
The problem I have is if you put a screen guard on there, the idea is it gets scratched, not the glass. Then you peel it off and put a new one on. But if you've sprayed quartz on there, well, I don't know. You're right. Yeah. Why wouldn't Apple or Samsung or Google do it if it's that good?
Yeah, that's true. But then that whole plan redundant.
How do you get quartz in a spray can? That's another question I'd like to know. Hey, good question. I don't know. We'll keep watch on that. That's great, Matthew. Thank you.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Thanks so much, Leo. Have a great week.
You too. What an interesting idea. They sprayed it with quartz. Anybody have any experience with such a thing? Never heard of it. But it's a good way to get an extra $20 out of you. You know, well, it's the undercoating of the smartphone set. That's a sign we've hit maturity, hasn't it? In the business, you know, they're starting to do stuff like that. Kate's on the line from Michigan. Our next call. Hi, Kate.
Hi, Leo.
Welcome.
Great to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you.
First of all, let me just say I've been following you on Twit TV for about 4 or 5 years. And the good nuns taught us back in the 50s that we should learn how to learn.
Thank you.
Let me say, I'm learning how to learn from you.
Bless you. But isn't this a fun subject?
Yes. And it affects everybody.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, you could learn a language, but this is something you use every day, all the time, everywhere.
Exactly. Well, I'd like to educate a little bit about genealogy. There's a lot of people who have very negative feelings about it. And let me just put it this way. Since we are all now hearing the truth news or, you know, real news or fake news, there's real genealogy and there's fake genealogy.
Well, I'm glad to hear this. And I think the younger people couldn't care less. But as we get older, and I notice this in myself, we care more and more about our ancestry. And maybe there's psychologically just this notion that we hope somebody will pay attention to us after we've passed and keep track of their roots. So I agree with you. I'm fascinated by genealogy all of a sudden.
Well, to me, it's about people. It's not about me. It's about people and learning about people.
Yeah. Now, what do you... I take it that you're an amateur genealogist. You like doing this.
I've been doing it 15 years, and my...
Tell me a little about the tools you use. Nowadays, you use software, I would think.
Well, yes, and software is the problem right now. You need to know where to go and, you know, what sites to hit and where to find things.
Right.
Important, but thing is, genealogy is more common users.
You know, I have to take a break because we're coming up at the top of the hour. Can you hang on for a bit? Because I'd like, when we come back, I'd like to talk a little bit more about what you recommend, what sites, because there are a lot of sites out there. There's Ancestry.com, there's Genealogy.com, there's the Mormons, and what software you recommend. Because I think this is something, I know you young people, you don't not worry about this, but I'm interested. Stay tuned. Leo LaPointe, the tech guy. Our show today brought to you by a company you may never have heard of, but if you're in business and you want to do video for training, for education, for promotion, for marketing, you ought to know about Wistia. Wistia, the video hosting platform for business. It gives you analytics and video marketing tools that power creative communication, and it really works. You know how I know? More than 300,000 businesses use Wistia today. When you host, now I know a lot of you perhaps are saying, oh, I just use YouTube. That isn't the environment you want for professional business video. Wistia is what you're looking for. You get detailed analytics so you can understand who's watching your videos and how it's performing. You can access things like heat maps, trend graphs, engagement graphs, really great, fascinating stuff that no one else gives you. You can capture email addresses with your video. So if you're using it for marketing, it's really useful. By the way, you get a video player with Wistia, and you can completely customize videos to match your brand. So it's much more professional looking. It's a difference between having an AOL email account for your business and having, you know, your businessname.com. That's what Wistia is. I have to say, you've got to get this. If you're using video in your business, it's very easy to integrate it with marketing automation software. If you're using Marketo or Pardo, Wistia offers friendly support service people who are available whenever you need it. Free resources to enable you to use video across your business, even if you've never made a video before. They make it easy. People who use Wistia are companies like Cirque du Soleil uses Wistia. Starbucks uses Wistia. HubSpot, the great marketing company, they all use Wistia as their video hosting platform. So you'll increase visibility, you'll boost conversion rates, you'll power your sales team, and you'll have the metrics to help you do your job better with Wistia. Start your free account, free right now at Wistia, Wistia, Wistia.com. And by the way, with a free account, you get 3 video uploads, you get advanced video analytics, and you get all the features and integrations built with business in mind. This is video for business. This is Wistia. Start today for free. Wistia, Wistia.com. We thank them so much for their support of the Tech Guy podcast. Now back to the show. I am Leo LaPointe, the Tech Guy. How you doing today? Time to talk computers, the internet, home theater, digital photography, smartphones, smartwatches, all that jazz, all that gimcrackery. And I was talking before the break, and I wanted to keep Kate on the line because there is something that you can use computers for that's kind of an old discipline, but computers seem like they're very well suited to it, and that is digging down and discovering your ancestry and finding out more about your forebears and that kind of thing, genealogy. Kate, thanks for hanging on. I appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome, Leo. I appreciate you being there.
So I want you to give me a mini lesson in if I wanted to start doing genealogy, where would I start? What would you recommend?
Well, most libraries have access to multiple sites. You know, when I talk on here, my brain goes,
Bing! I know. It's just you and me, Kate. Don't pay any attention to those other people. They're just snooping. Just
but,
you and me.
There's Ancestry.
I'm aware of the Ancestry.com, aware of Genealogy.com. I seem to remember that Genealogy is a link to the Mormon database. Am I right?
Well, some of it is. The thing that has happened that has made it blossom right now is because of the internet.
Yeah. You used to have to go to Salt Lake City, right?
Right.
Now, well, I can sit here and do it.
It's not just the Mormons. It's all over the world. You can go online and, like, I just found a record from a former forebearer, handwritten record from 63 for the baptism of somebody in my family. Yeah.
So you've got church records, you've got county records, you've got governmental records. There's, I mean, and nowadays more and more of this is online, isn't it?
It is. And to be able to go online and see the actual handwriting is very exciting.
Oh, I bet.
However, let me say something else. People getting involved in genealogy, I would highly recommend you don't go out and spend a bunch of money for software and access.
Well, I almost signed up for Ancestry.com, and I saw they wanted so much money. I said, maybe not.
Yeah, you can get Ancestry at your local library.
Aha.
You know, it's the library version. And I talked to you once before, and I'm going to mention a lady that I've been following for a number of years, Lisa Louise Cook. And she is very good on Google, but blending the internet and genealogy and seniors who are not real good on computers can be very difficult.
Yes. And I mean, that's challenging, isn't it? And yet this is the people who are most interested in this stuff would benefit so much from being able to use computers to do it.
And I really believe that Ancestry, there's Family Search is the Mormons. That's completely free, but it's a little more difficult. But all of those are good intentions, but they have multiple ways of doing things.
Right.
And there's essentially about four big ones. But
do you suggest not paying for a subscription to one of these sites?
I would not say do not pay a subscription. I would say look at what you are interested in. Go to your library.
Yeah.
And the most important thing is save everything you find to your hard drive. And Carbonite has been a godsend.
Oh, yeah. God bless our sponsor, I tell you. Now, if it used to be that, you know, I remember Broderbund made a program called Family Tree Maker. Used to be you'd use software, but I noticed that most of these sites, you could just do it on the site. Is the software available on these sites okay? Is it pretty good?
Well, that's the problem. There's multiple kinds of software. The ones I'm most familiar with are Family Tree Maker.
Yeah.
My first copy was from Broderbund.
Yeah. Is that still around?
Well, that's the one they just discontinued last fall.
Well, that's why I don't like the idea of doing it in software. What do you, you know, there is a standard, though, for the data, the GEDCOM standard, right?
Right, exactly. However, what's happening right now, and since 2005, I think, Family Tree Maker has synced their, you know, your tree on their website with your Family Tree software.
Oh, good. So you could, if the software stops working, you can access that data.
Well, you need it on your hard drive.
If
you stop paying Ancestry and you don't
That's what I was worried about. I don't want to pay $100 a year and then if I get bored, lose everything I've done.
And dream on for $100 a year, you might access your birth record.
they get you, don't they? Okay, see, that's good. My instinct was, I don't know if I want to pay for this. I don't know if that seems like it's going to add up. All right.
And everybody wants something different. And you don't know what you want until you start doing it. And my firm belief is start at the library. However, what I really want to ask you and your army of people to look at what's happening with this think. They're changing. It used to be, you know, I don't know words they use, but just a regular think where people and data synced with you, what you had on your hard drive.
Okay.
Well, last October or something, my dates may be wrong, but they stopped. They said they were going to stop supporting and updating.
See, this is where it really needs to be an open source project and not a commercial entity. And
you've got to have your information and have control of it.
I agree 100%. Do not put it in a database on a website where if you don't pay your subscription or they go out of business, you lose all that work.
Well, yes. Well, now that there was originally, they said Family Tree Makers discontinuing supporting it.
Right.
And then another program that's been around for years and I have a lot of respect for Roots Magic, worked out that they would do the sync, and their software would sync. So I updated my version of that software. Well, this was in November I did that, and everybody was anticipating by January 1st of this year, things would be working. We are way beyond January.
Kate, can I ask you if you've ever heard of Gramps? This is an open source genealogical research software. It's free, and it's a community project, not a commercial project.
There are multiple ones of those.
Okay. See, I'd feel more comfortable with that. I mean, especially if it supports the GEDCOM format, because then I know I could export my data, back it up, and then get it over to whatever the next program is. But you sure don't want to throw out all that research. This seems like it'd be a great hobby. We need to do more on this. We're running out of time, Kate. But I do thank you so much for calling in. Every family, I think, has one or two people, usually elders in the family, who pay attention to this stuff. And trust me, you will be glad as you get older. Thank you, Kate. It's great to talk to you. More of your calls still to come. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy. This is why we were talking before the break with Kate about genealogy. And, you know, it's been a mess, really, because there have been commercial programs, commercial sites. There's people, I frankly think, who are kind of gouging people. And this is, to me, one of the areas of computing where free and open software, to me, is what you need. Commercial companies come and go. Commercial file formats come and go. But if you've got a community of devoted, you know, amateurs, in effect, writing software, and the truth is there's great software being written by, you know, non-commercial entities, I feel like it's more likely they're going to support open standards and they're going to keep it going because they don't, you know, it's not based on the ability to make a profit. I know that sounds crazy. But I just feel like this is one area, and there are a number of areas where open source software is a very good idea. You don't want to get tied into something. We call it the opposite of open is proprietary. And if you get tied into something proprietary, then you've got no recourse if that company goes belly up or goes sideways. 8888 Ask Leo. Let's go back to the phones. And on the line right now, he's been very patient, Zach from Los Angeles. Hi, Zach.
Hi, Leo. Thank you very much for your wonderful program.
Thank you.
Question for you. I do some photography, but not that much. I have problem transferring the photos. Everywhere I want to transfer the photos to the people, they're asking for subscription. Is there anywhere that I can transfer the files without subscription?
So you're saying that you have, is it friends and family? Are you a professional shooter? Who is your audience? Who wants these photos?
Well, I'm right in the middle.
Okay. So you're semi-pro.
Yes.
Do you want to give people access to these photos for free, or do you want to charge them?
No, I'm not charging them.
You just want to make it easy for them to look at them.
Look at them or copy them, whatever they want.
So a lot of professionals, and I'm not a professional, but I use it, use a paid service. You said, I know you don't want to pay, so I'm not going to, you know, I'm just going to mention it. Called Smugmug, S-M-U-G-M-U-G, at smugmug.com. I use that because I do have photos family and friends want. I can share it privately, password protected. But here's the thing I like about it, and there are a number of other services like this. They can order prints, and SmugMug will print them. I could set it so that I get a profit, but I don't. I set it at SmugMug's cost. But it solves a lot of problems for people, for me, if people want prints. But if people are content to download the photo, oh, goodness, there are many ways to do it that are free. Flickr.
That's what I need to do.
Yeah.
I want them to download.
Yeah, Flickr, FLICKR.com is Yahoo's photo sharing site. Now, I know Yahoo's gone through a troubled time, and they got sold, and you know, I don't know if Flickr will be around. I think it will. There's just too many people use it. It's a great photo sharing site. It lets you store full quality photos on Flickr, let people browse them. You can have private folders. People can download directly in the full quality from Flickr. So that's one choice. You know, I always like Google Photos, and I recommend it. But Google Photos isn't full quality. I think they're fine, but they do compress them a little bit. But the nice thing about Google Photos is it has very sophisticated sharing capabilities. So, for instance, let's say you go to a wedding and you want to share the great photos you've taken of the bride and groom. You can do that if you have the email addresses of other participants. But you can also create a folder. So you can create a folder that they can read and download from. But you can also create a folder they can upload to. And I recommend if you've got an event like that, create one of these folders and give people the address of it. And say, hey, if you get any great pictures, please upload them here. And that way we can all see them. And I think...
Do they have passwords?
You have control over who can see it, who can edit it. You can share it with people.
You're talking about the Google Photos.
Google Photos. The disadvantage of this is everybody has to have a Google account. Nowadays, that's not much of a bar, but you do have to have a Google account to do that. Flickr, you have to have a Yahoo account. You know, it's similar. Facebook does some of the same things. I personally prefer Google Photos, but again, that is a little bit more of a challenge if you know that some of the people you want to share the photos with are not Google, don't have a Google account. That's going to be a little bit more challenging. Is that a showstopper for you?
Yes, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Oh, no, I mean, is requiring a Google account going to be a problem?
I don't know. I don't know if people, they have Google email account or
yeah.
They don't.
Most of these sites. There's also Shutterfly is another one that's used to be owned by Kodak. I'm not sure if it's still owned by Kodak. But they let you make photo books. They let you share. They're more commerce focused. But it is absolutely set up so that you can share photos because their hope is that people will then go on the site and buy mugs and calendars and prints and so forth. And that's how they make their money. Anybody in the chat room got an additional? At this point, Kodak owns Shutterfly owns Kodak, probably.
It's Photoshop. Yeah, it goes out on cloud.
Yeah, Adobe has its own sharing system. But again, you'd have to have an Adobe account.
I do have Photoshop and I do have...
Yeah, well, Adobe has, what is it called? Create? I can't remember the name of its sharing.
Yes, that's called Creative Account.
Yeah.
Creative Cloud.
Yeah, and that works, but again, I think people will have to create an Adobe account to use it.
I see.
So I think Google is your best bet because almost everybody has Google. Google now also just announced they're going to offer photo books as well, which is something they never offered before. And now they aren't very sophisticated in terms of the variety. Apple and Adobe do a much better job if you want to spend some time editing a book. Google's, you know, slice on this is we're going to make these books easy to create because we're going to use our machine learning and our artificial intelligence to suggest your best pictures. And then all you have to do is say yes or no, and we'll create the book. They're also inexpensive. The soft cover books start at $10. The hardcover books at $20. And I have to say, Google does a very nice job of the printing. I would say this is as good as the Apple or Adobe printing. Very nicely done. So, I'll keep listening because I think people in the chat room might have some suggestions. Others might have some ideas. This is a good question, particularly if you don't want, and I don't know of any way to do this, if you don't want somebody to have a Google account. Now, maybe, let me think about this, and DLR in the chat room saying, you know, I think you can send a link to the folder without, and somebody can look at it. They can't upload to it, but they can look at it without having a Google account. It becomes.
Okay, I'm going to try it.
I would try Google. Yeah, I would try Google. Dropbox will let you do that too. Dropbox has a photo sharing capability.
I know, but Dropbox.
You have to pay for it. Yeah. The beauty of Google is they make their money in other ways, so they don't charge you for what I consider to be a really superb photo sharing system. This is like they based it on the old Picasa and Picasa Web, which remember they bought, but they no longer use. Hey, good question. We'll keep looking for good answers. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Let's take some calls. People have been holding on. They're very patient, like Dan in Fresno. Hi, Dan. Dan, are you there? Speak to me. Talk to me, my friend. Oh, he's been holding on for so long. I think he... Listen, do you hear any snoring? That actually happened to us once. I picked up the phone, and our caller was just... Dan? Maybe I'm doing something wrong. Let me put Dan back on hold here. And try Glenn while you, if Heather, you'd see if you can figure out what's going on with Dan. Glenn's in Winnetka, hello, Glenn. Maybe our phones have decided to give up the ghost. How about Elena in Boise, Idaho? Hi, Elena.
Hello, how's it going, Leo?
It's going great. How are you?
Good, thanks. Okay, so my question for you is this. I'm a teacher, and I'm looking into getting an iPad Pro, mostly for use. In my classroom and developing content for my classroom, grading, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to decide if I should buy the current version or wait, and if the iPad Pro 2 would potentially be a significant upgrade worth the wait.
Yeah, but when would they release it? They didn't release it this spring. We thought they might. Right. They're due, but Apple doesn't... I have no special connection to Apple, I'm sorry to say. That's a very good question. Where is the new iPad Pro? Apple does have an event coming up in June. It's over. WWDC. I don't think they announced any new iPads. I don't know when the new iPads are going to be. Maybe this fall. I think maybe they've moved them to a fall release date. So, since you're a teacher, are you? You're off for summer, right?
Yep.
Can you wait till the fall?
Yeah, till the fall. I was kind of thinking it would be nice to have it over the summer, though, kind of to prepare.
I love the iPad Pro. We had heard rumors that there was going to be a third iPad Pro that would be a bigger screen, but not a bigger form factor. You know, it would be the size of the existing 9.7-inch iPad Pro, but would have a 10.5-inch screen by having a smaller frame. That would be the one I would get. Because I had the big 12-inch iPad Pro, and it was too big. It felt like you're carrying a tea tray or something. It's just gigantic. I have the 9.7, right, and I love it. I wish I could give you better information, but okay. Golly, Apple never tells me nothing.
No problem. Yeah, it's not until the fall. My gut
is it will be in October.
Okay. Great.
Thanks for the
Thank
call.
You so much.
Let's try Dan again. Let's see if we can get Dan on the line. Hi, Dan.
Hey, Leo.
I'm sorry about that. Welcome.
Thanks. I got a couple questions. I'm looking for a budget soundbar. We have a 42-inch Vizio.
Okay.
And my mom is looking to spend about $250, $300. The problem she's having is that she's having trouble hearing dialogue.
Yeah.
So she was wondering if there was one where we could, raise the center channel so we could
Almost all of these will allow you to boost the center channel. The idea of a sound bar is it replaces a surround sound system with 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 speakers with a single long speaker right at the TV. But if you look inside a sound bar, there are multiple speakers inside the sound bar, and that's how they get, kind of, they simulate surround sound, and they do have separate center channels. I'm looking at the Wirecutter, which is one of my favorite review sites. They really are doing a bang-up job, and they say the Vizio SmartCast, is at the top of a very short list, $250, which is a pretty darn good price.
Mm-hmm.
It has all the features you'd want, wireless and wired connectivity, support for Bluetooth so you could play your phone music through it. It supports Google Cast, which is another great way to send audio to it. It has an optical input, which is probably what you're going to have on the TV. So make sure you get an optical cable that goes from the TV to it. But it also supports HDMI, and that your TV may, you know, work better with the audio return channel HDMI, although most of the time you want to connect an optical cable. So
okay, so optical is better then, because I do have HDMI on that.
Yeah, you'll want to, in almost every case, you'll use optical coming out of the TV into the soundbar.
Okay.
That's going to give you a great experience. And boy, at that price, so there's a number of different Vizio SmartCast models. The one that's $250 is the SB3851. The SB.
You know what? I saw that one, and then they had some. They had different models with that same number, and then like D0 at the end.
Yeah. So D0 it means that you don't get. You don't. Let's see. What do you get? It's the number of additional speakers, I believe.
Well, they looked like there was the same description and everything. That's
all right.
I wasn't sure.
Well, I the one they recommend is the D0 or the DO. I don't know if that's an O or a zero. But they do say a step up for a little more money would be the 4551 D5. But I think that's they're both 5.1. Look, they come with a sub. This is pretty nice. Boy, that price, that's pretty good.
You know, I was wondering if those were like the year, you know, kind of, you know, was that was like the 2016 one and the C?
Yeah, no, I don't think so. Generally speaking, the Wirecutter's talking about current stuff. Go to thewirecutter.com and look at their best budget soundbar article, and that'll give you several different recommendations. But they really, I haven't tried the Vizios, but I'm not surprised. If you want to spend a little more money, or you don't want a subwoofer, if you just want the soundbar, Yamaha makes one with built-in subwoofers, although those aren't going to be very, you know, deep in the sub, because there's, you know, you can't, the size of the speaker directly impacts how bassy a subwoofer is. So
I remember you mentioning accessories for less.com. They have a Yamaha model, I think it's the YAS-203, and that one has the sub, and it has something called Clear Voice.
Yeah.
I guess it's specifically for dialogue.
Yeah, those are good.
Okay.
Yeah, those are good.
It was around that same price.
Yeah. The reason I'm referring to the Wirecutter is I just haven't tested a whole bunch of soundbars, so
right.
I can't give you a direct experience, but I trust these guys. They got bought by the New York Times about 3 months ago, but they're still doing just great work. I'm really a fan. And so thewirecutter.com, take a look at what they recommend. And yeah, I think the Clear Voice is probably a good idea. If, you know, I have the same problem, you know, as you get older, you get, why is that darn music in the background so loud? I can't hear him talk.
And
it's really a question of getting that center channel up. In fact, that's the best argument for a 5.1 system, is you can have a separate speaker for the voice, and you can crank it. Almost all AV receivers will allow you to boost the center channel. The Clear Voice might make a big difference. That might be worth going with the Yamaha. They make good stuff.
The other thing I had was Xfinity X-Fi. What's that? The difference between that and what I already have.
So you don't have an X1 box, you just have the regular Xfinity box?
No, I have the X1, but they're talking, I got a notification, something about X5.
Yeah, I think that, I may be wrong, but I think that they're talking about 4K.
They were talking about that they had invested in the plume.
Yeah, I love the plumes. Oh, okay, X5. Wait a minute, let me take a look at this.
Because they have something called X5, and then
no, X5, but they're not offering the plume yet. This is an Aeris or a Cisco wireless gateway, and I'll tell you why I'm not crazy about this. You're going to become a Wi-Fi access point for Xfinity Wi-Fi.
And yes, you already turned that off on the one that I have.
I'm sure you can turn it off, but that's why they want to move people to this new hardware. You know, I really like having my own Wi-Fi devices and controlling them personally. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hey, we'll be back with more of the Tech Guy Show in just a bit, but I have to tell you about one of the companies that brings you this podcast every week, and a company, by the way, that brings us great travel resources. It's called Upside at upside.com. It's for business travelers. It's for any company, including, you know, a small company like ours, a medium-sized company, any company that doesn't have their own travel department. When you work for a big company, and I used to, and when you work like NBC or Ziff Davis, when I work for those big companies, when you're going to do business travel, you don't book it yourself. You don't want to. You go to the travel department. You call them, you tell them your time and dates, and they do it all for you. It's like your own, you know, internal travel agent. But the beauty part is they've got pre-negotiated deals with so that you get the best possible deal. That's why the company has you do it. But a lot of companies like mine, we're not big enough to have a travel department. So think of Upside.com as your new corporate travel department. And I'll tell you why. First of all, and by the way, it was started by Jay Walker, who did Priceline. This is his new thing. He's, you know how entrepreneurs are. They see an opportunity, some category is not well served, and they say, hey, I could do that. And that's how he came up with Upside.com. The idea is you go there, you tell them where you want to go. They will book both the flight and the hotel, pre-negotiated prices, so you save your company a lot of money. And by the way, it's not overwhelming. It's not a big long, it's not like those other sites where you just get, you know, hundreds of listings, pages of listings. You get the top six listings right off the bat. You know the airline, you know the flight time, you know the hotel. There's no mystery. If you want more, you can say, there's a button that says, give me 30 more curated suggestions and 30 more. So you can keep going. But generally, those six top ones are the ones where you're going to get the best deal. They'll be easiest for you. They'll fit your schedule. And then here's the best part. Your company saves money. You book that flight. But you also get a gift card, a little reward for yourself. $100, $200, a $300 gift card. You get even more with overseas travel. And it's all yours. And these aren't just, you know, these are great gift cards. They have 50 different businesses. But, you know, Amazon, they've got Target. They've got Nordstrom. I mean, businesses that you would want to do business with. You'll get your gift card within 72 hours of making the booking. Via email. They even have a page where you can keep track of your gift cards. Now, if you are a proprietor, as I am, I didn't want the gift card. I just applied the value of the gift card to the travels, and I saved even more on travel. You can do that too. But if you're booking for yourself and it's your company that's paying for it, take the gift card. It is a great reward for business travel. And yes, you still get all your miles. You still get all the other benefits. It's just an extra little something for you from Jay and the Upside folks. Go right now to Upside.com. When you do book, if you do me a favor, use the offer code TECHGUY. That way they'll know you saw it here. But you'll also get a benefit. They guarantee you then a $100 minimum gift card, at least a $100 gift card. So it's like I'm giving you $100 to use Upside. Just make sure you use that offer code TECHGUY. Minimum purchase is required. You should see the site for complete details. Upside.com. Save big on travel and get a big gift card every single trip. It's a win-win. Upside.com. Now back to the show. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy, and you know what time it is? It's Howdy Doody time. No, it's not Howdy. It's Dick D. Bartolo.
It's Howdy Dicky time.
I don't know if I really want to call it that, Dick. Dick D. Bartolo is Mad Magazine's maddest rightist. We call him the maddest writer. Maddest rightist. We call him the Giz. I'm punchy.
Oh, you needed a vacation.
It's the end of the show. I'm going on vacation right now.
Okay.
He is the maddest writer, and we bring him in every week to talk about a gadget. And I'm looking at your website, gizwiz.biz, and I just can't. Is that a? It looks like a solar airplane or something. What is it?
Yeah, okay, so it's a little. It looks like a lantern. It's made out of stainless steel.
Yeah.
And I must say that. A woman who was listening to GizWiz said, you guys like gadget? I'm going to send you something my company makes. And so this, it looks like a little tiny little fireplace in there.
Yeah.
And so it takes a tea light. One of those
tiny
little.
There's a little votive candle in there?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. After the candle is in there for about 4 minutes, the LED lights come on.
Wait a minute.
Because
the candle's powering.
Generating.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes. It's a little thermoelectric furnace in there, and the 8 LED lights come on.
And then that hood, which is great for like outdoor dinners and stuff, that hood can lift up about 12 inches.
How heavy is this?
You know, I think it weighs 5 or 6 pounds.
It looks kind of, okay. It looks, but it's quite a, contraption.
it is quite a contraption. Now, you get 4 hours of light out of one votive candle.
Wow.
And I actually timed it. I got 4 hours and 4 minutes out of it. So you take the one little candle, and this device makes it 100 times brighter because now it lights 8 LEDs.
All of that. See, this is the thing. This is what we're learning here is that votive candles, tea candles, are wasteful. They're inefficient. All that heat could be used for something more productive, like lights.
Assuming you have that little generator thing in there that can take the heat and turn it into electricity.
Can you charge your cell phone from this as well?
Not yet, no. No, I put a giant candle in there and tried to power my TV, but it didn't work.
What the now, how much is this?
This is not inexpensive. It's $107 on Amazon.
Wow.
But if you do a web search, the lowest I found it for was $89. But it looks – Dennis just loves this. He thinks this is great for parties, a great conversation starter.
Well, it is because it's just a candle in there, but it's got all this light.
All this light, it looks like a miniature fireplace. And then when you tell people that the LEDs are also powered – by the little votive candle, people are very impressed.
Yes.
And it's stainless. It's really neat.
Is there a fan or something that the heat's
turning? No, there's no fan. So it's called the Joy Tea Light Lantern. And you can raise it up as you wish.
Oh, whoa, that's really bright.
Yeah.
You could use that for your TV studio.
I'm using it now. That's why it looks so good.
But Dick does do a show, a podcast called the GizWiz Podcast. You can find it at gizwiz.tv. How is Chad doing, your co-host, Chad Johnson? I love Chad.
Chad is great. We're having a great time. Leo, we're going into year three
Wow.
of being an independent show. It's like bizarre.
Wow.
Just That's bizarre. A long time. Yeah.
Yeah. And you still, there's still enough junk to come up with it.
There's still,
I used to host this show, but you practically bankrupted me because we started doing Sky Mall.
Oh, yeah.
And junk we found on Sky Mall. And I still have a lot of that junk. I got a robot in the other room, life-size.
Well, you know, I think you personally kept Sky Mall in business 2 years beyond when
they eventually went bankrupt. But for the last couple of years, they were running on my money.
Well, we do cheapy gadgets.
You know what's going to bring SkyMall back? You heard that that they're considering banning laptops on flights?
Yes.
That would be great for SkyMall. Bring it back.
But terrible for us. Oh, my gosh.
You're going to have to read that catalog. Nothing else to do. Gizwiz.biz is Dick DiBartolo's website, GIZWIZ.biz. You can find more information about the, what is that called? The Tea Light. Lantern?
The tea light lantern, exactly, from Caframo.
Caframo? I thought you said Caframo. It was from Joy.
The company is Caframo.
Who would name a company Caframo? That sounds like something you'd make up in Mad Magazine.
Well, they did make it up. It's a Canadian company, and they originally just produced fans, and for some reason they just edit things together.
They're not just good. They're Caframo.
It's called the Joy, but they spell it J-O-I, the Joy Tea Light Lantern.
Wow. Wow. Do you find Dick at GizWiz.biz? You can find that information there. But if you click the GizWiz visits the tech eye. But don't forget, very important, play the What the Heck Is It contest. You've got, till the end of this month, right?
End of this month, exactly. Yeah,
wow.
End of June.
So you're going to look at a picture of a gizmo or a gadget. It's a kind of, it looks like it kind of one of those air fresheners you plug in, but it's not that, right? It wouldn't be that obvious.
No, I'm not going to be that obvious.
Okay. It's always a little weird. But it's kind of fun because if you get it right, you're in the drawing for 12 autographed copies of Mad Magazine. You get it wrong, you're in the drawing for 24 copies of Mad Magazine. As usual, everything Dick does is completely upside down. He rewards you for the best wrong answer.
Yeah, and sometimes they're so stupid we have to give 28 issues away because we can't whittle it down to 24 dumb answers.
All the details and a lot more available at Dick's website, gizwiz.biz. Somebody's telling me that Chad got a dog named Charlie.
That is correct. We have a dog named Charlie, and Chad has a dog named
That's
Charlie.
That's not confusing at all.
No, not at all.
He's been testing out gadgets. Have you played at all with fidget spinners, by the way?
You know what? I have three on order because they now have LED fidget spinners.
Oh.
So I had to jump in. And
anything with an LED, Dick will order.
Yes.
This is a known fact.
Yes. And do you have stackable fidgets?
So, no. Let me explain what the regular fidget is first so people understand what we're talking about. This was invented for kids who were a little, you know, ADD, a little fidgety in the classroom. And it's just, it's a thing with three weighted arms and a pivot in the middle. And you just hold it in the middle and you spin it. And that's all it does. But apparently that calms these kids because they can play with that. Although
and some adults.
I have about 80 of them now. I just keep there's all kinds and they're everywhere. I don't go anywhere without them. Not that I'm fidgety. I don't know. But the thing about these is they become such a plague in our schools that they're now banning them.
Well, at least they're not using their phones.
Yeah, right. So you said stackable spinner?
Yes, so that the ones that I ordered, one fits inside the other, so you can spin one way and spin the other way. And when they have lit LEDs, they make really fantastic designs in the dark.
Oh, that's cool.
So if you find you have another one, that maybe they're all stackable. I don't know.
Maybe next week we should just do it. No, they're not all stackable. Maybe we should just a whole thing on fidget spinners at some point. Gizwiz.biz. It'd be fun. Gizwiz.biz.
Yeah, okay.
Dickie D, thank you so much.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks to everybody who joined the show. Of course, to our musical director, Michael Cozio, to Kim Schaffer and Heather Hammond, who do the phones for us. I'm Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Have a great geek week. Well, that's it for the Tech Guy show for today. Thank you so much for being here. And don't forget, it's just the tip of the iceberg. We do nearly 30 shows on the Netcast Network. It's called TWIT, T-W-I-T. It stands for This Week in Tech, and you'll find it at twit.tv, including the podcasts for this show. We talk about Windows on Windows Weekly, Macintosh on Mac Break Weekly, iPads, iPhones, Apple Watches on iOS Today, security on Security Now. I mean, I can go on and on and on. You even get your daily dose of tech news with Tech News Today. And, of course, the big show every Sunday afternoon, This Week in Tech. You'll find it all at twit.tv. And I'll be back next week with another great Tech Guy show. Thanks for joining me. We'll see you next time.